This is part two in a two-part series. Please listen to part one before continuing with this episode. This series contains discussion of murder, crime scenes, and graphic violence. Listener discretion is strongly advised. This is The Fall Line. Last episode, we introduced you to Nut Fan and Jackie Nguyen, a couple who ran their own small business in Birmingham, Alabama. Their nail salon, Top Perfect Nails, was popular with locals, and they were well-liked by neighborhood business owners and residents alike. They had a strong customer base of regulars who appreciated their kindness and willingness to open early and stay late. Nut and Jackie met several years before, after both of their previous marriages ended. They'd both spent time living in Florida, separately with their first spouses. Jackie had also owned nail salons in Puerto Rico and Atlanta, and each had older children of their own. Nut had relocated to Birmingham to be with Jackie and liked it there. She encouraged her daughter Tao to move to the city too. Tao had just gone through a divorce herself and was considering permanently resettling in Birmingham with her young children. But because of a custody issue, her children remained behind in Dothan, Alabama, with her ex-husband's family. In another circumstance, Tao might have moved back there herself. But Nut was diagnosed with cancer, and she needed to be nearby to help her mother through the treatments. For Christmas 2010, Tao had traveled back to Dothan to see her kids, but she came right back to Birmingham for work. She hadn't had a chance to see her mother before she got a call from her stepsister, Linda, that there had been a horrible incident at the salon. Linda, Jackie's oldest child, lived in Birmingham and worked at the salon during the summers when school was out. She was a new mother in 2010 and looking for a new apartment for her growing family when her own mother called to let her know Jackie and Nut had been found dead at Top Perfect Nails. Linda was in shock. She began making calls. She called Tao. She tried to reach her own younger sister, Jackie, named after their father, and Tao began to call her own brothers, who were living back in Florida, where their father still resided, telling them, "You have to come." Though Linda, Tao, and other friends and family arrived at the salon as quickly as they could, they weren't allowed in. The bodies of their parents were still inside. Linda talked to us about what she could remember. She was outside for hours as people gathered, and she answered as many questions as she could for the investigators.
So they were like testing for fingerprints and things like that. And I was begging them to let me go see them, and they wouldn't let me because they say that it's not a site that I want to see and things like that. And I was like, no, I really need to see my dad. So they finished testing for fingerprints or whatever, and they finally let us walk in.
By the time they were allowed in, it was late in the day. Linda and Tao tell us that they remember arriving at different times. Linda remembers being instructed that she could not enter because Jackie and Nut's bodies were still inside. And when Tao arrived later, she was instructed to remain outside because the fingerprinting was in process. Tao tells us that, to her knowledge, the precise number of shots fired at Jackie has never been released to the public, though the police did inform the family. Out of caution, we will avoid being more specific here. We will say, though, that he was shot in the main room of the salon. The family saw evidence of that as they did their slow walkthrough. Nut's injuries have been more specifically reported on in the local media, who went so far as to describe her as being shot multiple times while sitting in a chair in the office area of the salon. Nut's wounds were described to Tao as well, but what she saw inside Top Perfect Nails confused her. Specifically, Tao noticed something about the office-style chair that her mother had been sitting in at the time of the murders.
When we went into the shop to see what had happened, the client chair, where the client sit down, that's where my mom was sitting. When we was examining it, we see a bullet hole on the left side.
Was it in the area where someone's head might be if they were sitting?
If you are short like me, because I'm 4'10", then it would be where my head is at. When my mom's body was brought to Pensacola, the funeral home person, the mortician, found a bullet hole. It was through her wrist. We were thinking, like me and my siblings were thinking, whenever she was on the ground, I guess the guy stood over her or whoever, the person stood over her, I guess put a gun to her or whatever. You know how when you're trying to block something, you put your arm up? We're thinking that's what she did, where she put the arm up when she did that. I guess when he shot, you can see that bullet hole through her wrist. I don't think the detective noticed about that one.
That was a wound that was never described to Tal by investigators. She and her siblings could only guess at the exact way the attack had played out against their mother. We asked Linda and Tal what information they'd learned about the crime scene, whether any information had been discovered. Linda explained the difficulty of using fingerprint evidence in the case.
So when the police came there to investigate, they dug for fingerprint, but they say that they couldn't use any of it because there were multiple fingerprints on top of each other. It was like layers, and they couldn't like dissect it. Then my dad had a video recorder in there, but the tape wasn't in there. So I don't know, did someone take it or he didn't put any in there or what? And then like the cameras in front of the other shop, I think they say that it was a red car, if I can remember, but they couldn't, like, cause it was so far away. You know, it was across the street on a busy highway too. So they couldn't get any license plate, the make of the car. All they saw was the color, and they didn't see the faces of anyone that was there.
They couldn't be sure that was definitely somebody that was involved.
Right, right.
Were you ever interviewed?
I think I was. We were in front of my dad's shop. The news was there.
Oh, I mean by the police. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, never.
Tal told us about a few facts that they don't think made it to the newspaper, but could prove important to the case.
I think the detective told me they got a shoe print. One shoe print that they got. It was a 9mm case that they got. Detective said there's no cameras. They had a camera next door to the shop. The only thing they caught was a car tire going in and out. That was it. But I know there's a Wells Fargo right there. You know, it's because it's a big plaza.
Tal says she learned this information during her police interview, which occurred days after the crime. For reasons that have never been clear to her, she was asked to come in for further questioning.
All they said was the detectives say that they think it's a robbery. I'm going to tell you, if it's a robbery, would a robbery steal everything that they see? Money, necklace, gold?
We have not been able to verify what was and was not recorded into evidence by police, as they've not responded to our FOIA or our request for comment. We know that items were stolen from the shop, but that, in Tal's opinion, there was certainly more that could have been taken. Which leads her, at least, to question whether simple robbery was the only motive. As Linda told us last episode, her side of the family did find the petty cash missing, though the tip jar was in place. She was able to confirm with her mother that her father's cell phone and wallet were also missing, although his jewelry and other valuable personal items were not. In Nutt's case, there was a single item missing that Tao is sure of, her mother's cell phone. Tal noticed it was absent, and she said that she let detectives know. She told us that she asked about the possibility of getting her mother's cell phone records.
They said they got to get a warrant to do all that. And I was like, okay, well, there might be something. And they're like, well, we have to get a warrant for that. That was it.
Tal isn't sure if the records angle was ever explored. There was something else, too. Tal said that Nutt and Jackie's house was in disarray when she arrived there later on. She says she has no idea why or who could have been there searching for something. There's always the possibility that the two events are unconnected, or that someone heard they'd been killed and knew that they wouldn't come home and took advantage of that fact to go through their apartment. But Tao had to consider whether there was some link between the events.
The house is empty. The house is flipped upside down. The only thing that's valuable to us was my mom, you know, our pictures. That's all we took was the pictures. Pictures when we were kids and stuff.
Back to the police questioning that Tao told us about. To Tao's knowledge, she was the only person in the family who was interviewed by the police after the initial questioning occurred outside the salon. As Linda mentioned, she was not interviewed after that initial discussion outside. In fact, she didn't know Tao had been interviewed at the station until we spoke to them both for these episodes. Tao felt there was some suspicion cast on her, but she couldn't understand why. And Linda is not aware of any reason Tao would have been questioned either.
When all this situation had happened, I went down to the police station because they say they heard rumors about me. I was a suspect. The crazy thing is, it was just only me get pulled in. Nobody else. The detective had interviewed me about that, talking about why is my mom's house flipped upside down. I'm like, I don't know. They seen that me and my mom had an altercation a while back. I'm like, why would I have an altercation? My question to them was, why would I do anything to harm my mom whenever I left my whole life back in Dothan, my kids, to be up here with my mom? And when I found out she had cancer, I stayed to take care of my mom. I'm like, why would I do that? And this is the only mom that I have in my life. So why would I do that to harm my mom? Why would I leave my family, my kids, to take care of my mom? And the detective was like, well, you know, we just got to go by what people say. And I'm like, but y'all interviewing me. Y'all not interviewing nobody else but me.
The rumors, whatever they were, obviously did not come from Linda's family. They had no idea Tao was even questioned. So who had suggested that she might be responsible, and why? Was there a purposeful intent to misguide or direct away from someone else? Police seemed to have abandoned that line of inquiry because Tao was not brought in again. But she did hear other rumors, around town and at work, about a possible motive for the murders of Jackie and Nut. Not robbery, but revenge. Or rather, a kind of payback.
I work at a nail shop, so I hear a lot of people tell me, do you know that he gambled? My mom would tell me, Jackie took me to the casino every weekend to make me happy when, you know, when they found out about the cancer. When you borrow money from the wrong people, you don't pay them back. You know, they will do bad things to you. Do I think my mom was there at the wrong place at the wrong time? I can't tell you. If they wouldn't get Jackie there, then they wouldn't get Jackie somewhere.
When this happened, were you able to sit down with police and speak with them? Were you or anyone else from your family able to tell the police that you had heard that Jackie had debts?
No.
When we spoke with Linda about Jackie and Nut's case, she also brought up the gambling rumor. It was presented to her as the only possible reason someone could have wanted to hurt her father, who was so well-loved. But she doesn't believe that he had a gambling problem.
I talked to my sister about this, and this is what she heard someone said. It's not concrete facts or anything like that, but she said she heard someone said that Dad had a gambling problem and that he owed a lot of money and that they came after him. I shot that idea down immediately. I'm like, no. I'm like, seriously? I was like, come on. I don't believe that at all. I don't know. Maybe people like to spread rumor when people are, like, not alive anymore because, like, they can't defend themselves. But I don't think that's true at all, because I've been around my dad for so long. I even work at the nail salon with him during the summer. So if he had any type of like game room problem, like, I mean, something would like show, you know what I mean?
So your sister said she heard that. Did she say where she heard it?
It's an Asian community. People talk. So I don't know if one of her friends heard it from somebody that they work with. She told me about it, but I was like, no, absolutely not. I don't believe that.
You feel like you would see signs?
Yeah. I just feel like if you've been around someone for so long, if they have some type of like addiction or some type of bad habit, eventually it will come to light. Because, you know, you can hide it only for so long. I just don't think that it's like that.
Because we've been unable to speak with officials, we don't know whether this possibility, gambling debts, has been explored or ruled out, but the topic was not reported in local media. Jackie's car was another possible area of inquiry, as the families told us there was a suggestion that he could have been bringing groceries into the shop from his vehicle when he was attacked. However, they don't know what ultimately happened to his Lincoln Navigator. It was initially taken into evidence, but then there were complications.
The police have the keys to it and everything. And at that time, because I don't know anything about rules or politician or the bureaucracy or anything like that. So I was figuring, because my dad was, you know, God, they were going to give me the keys to his car to, like, you know, take it home. And they were like, no, I have to go to this location, fill out some paperwork and get it. So when I got there, there was like, well, do you have power of attorney? And I'm just like, no, I don't. And they were like, well, we can't release it to you until you go get that paperwork done. Because I was only 18 at that point. I'm running around like a chicken with my head cut off trying to get this stuff done. And I could not do it for the life of me. I tried calling different places, but it's like, well, you need this in order to do this. So it's just like, well, I can't do this. I can't get this done if I don't have this paperwork. So it's just a lot of like going back and forth. So I was so tired, and I'm just like, forget it. It's okay at that point in my life, because I was just so exhausted of running back and forth, trying to get that car out of the compound.
So it stayed in compound?
Yeah. I don't know if they eventually, if the state sold it or what. Yeah, it stayed there because I couldn't get it out, because biologically he wasn't my dad and he wasn't on my birth certificate. They were giving us a runaround, and we needed power of attorney, things like that. It was just really hard to do at that time because she was 16, I was 18. We were not familiar with things like that.
While evidence may have been recovered from the Lincoln Navigator, we have no information on that subject. There was no further discussion of Jackie's vehicle in the media. In fact, after a 2012 anniversary article, there were very few updates that we could include in this episode. In a long-running case, that can be the norm. Without developments or new public pleas, it can be difficult to attract the attention of reporters. It's something that Eric Carter-Londin discussed during our interview with him concerning his brother's case and how traditional journalists might better serve families of victims. Families we've spoken with want, more than anything else, to know that their loved ones have not been forgotten. This can mean by the community, by the media, or by law enforcement. Sometimes all three. After Jackie's murder, Linda's husband handled their communications with the media and with law enforcement. It was just too much for her at the time, especially after her issues trying to get his car out of impound. So, I know you said that your husband was calling in and checking, and they were saying they're working on it. At what point did you stop hearing from law enforcement on the case?
We were calling like every month for updates. It was after about a year that I stopped calling, because it's been a whole year, and every time I call, well, he called, you know, and that's all we would hear. It's just very discouraging and very disappointing, and I don't know, I just got discouraged, and I just didn't want to hear that anymore. I want to at least hear something like, we got a lead or something, but they never follow up with anything. So I just got tired and I just didn't want to hear anymore. So after a year, we stopped trying to reach them.
Have they given you any updates since then?
None. Nothing.
Linda told us that she has not reached out since the first year of the investigation. It was just too discouraging for her to hear only that the investigation was ongoing. We know that can simply be the reality in an open case, that there's not news or not information that can be shared with the family. Tao, though, has continued to contact Birmingham for updates since 2010, and she says she feels frustration at the difficulty she's had getting a response.
The last time I had reached out to them, and it took a God know how long for a detective to finally call me back. And when I tell you, I called all the time, and the lady would be like, we'll leave a message. Or this other person say, we'll leave a message. And it took days, weeks for somebody to call you back. And the last detective I talked to, I know is a new detective, a new cold case detective. And he say that he had do a new thing where they put it on Facebook at the county, at the whole state of Alabama in a prison or jail county. If the TV's on, you can see the page, and it will have a mom picture on it too. And then the detective say, if anybody have any info, they can reach out to whatever number is on the bottom of that Facebook.
Social media campaigns are very important to cold cases. Our own experiences have shown us that. Expanding this kind of outreach to all platforms and combining it with regular media collaboration on a department's cold cases, especially those with rewards in place, has even more impact. 2 years after the murders of Jackie and Nutt, the Birmingham News ran an anniversary piece on their case and spoke to a BPD detective, quote, I feel because nobody has talked, there has to be somebody they're scared of. When the community loves someone the way they love them, they usually come forward. We're convinced that someone out there knows exactly what happened, and we just need them to get the courage to come forward. The family members deserve justice, and our community needs to see this case solved. Linda and Tao and their families are still waiting for that justice. Linda talked to us about how she's dealt with that for more than a decade.
I grieve with myself, by myself. I didn't really let my family know about it because I just don't want to affect them. I just don't want them to see me sad. So I still continue to just move on, go to work with the school. I just now just look at the glass half full instead of half empty. I still get very emotional when I talk about my dad, because he's such a good person, and he left such a good mark on me and other people that he surrounds himself by. It's just very sad to see him go like that. You know, it wasn't his time yet. I feel like he got robbed of his time on earth because, you know, he has a grandson and granddaughter that he never got to meet, never got a chance to, like, hold, kiss on, love on, take him to the park, things like that. But I know the memories that he left with me are very genuine, and I will forever treasure those memories. So I just try to focus on how he made me feel growing up, and I think about that so that I won't be so sad when I talk about him. Because when it first happened, I couldn't even talk about it. But then it got to the point where I'm able to talk about it, and I was crying. Now I'm talking about it, and I'm not as sad, and I'm not crying as much. So I think I'm improving in that aspect of my grief. But it would never go away, of course, because I love him so much. One day, I do hope to find closure to give him some justice. But if I can't, you know, I just have to make peace with that.
Tao reflected on how the murder of her mother affected her family in further reaching ways. She feels they're more disconnected now and have only come together once, fully, for a wedding since Nutt's death. She also worries about her only living parent, her father, who still lives in Florida. He remarried and had another child after his divorce from Nutt, but like the rest of his family, he was deeply affected by her death.
How did your dad take the loss of her?
He was hurt. It changed his ways of living now. I mean, he's married, he had a child, but we see that it changed his way of living. We had to show him that he don't need to live like how he's living now. He basically is like, oh well, if he die, he die. If he walk out on this earth and somebody shot him, oh well. We try to tell him, like, we don't want to lose you like how we lost mom. So don't think like that. You get kids, you get grandkids you need to worry about. So don't think like that. She made our family complete. My family is, we all separated right now. We talk to each other here and there. But I know the big difference. When she was alive, our family was together. Complete. She was this giving. She was very, very giving. She would give you the last penny that she had. She'd give you the last clothes on her back. The traits I have with her is, oh, is the giving part. My husband always yelled, he's like, you always make people happy before you make yourself. Just like with the homeless. My mom used to give homeless money and never food, just money. And it'd be the same person. I tell my mom, that's the same man you giving the money to. She's like, it's okay. Because what I do for some a person is always a blessing. I get them from her. I always give this man food, money. And my husband sit there and be like, that man probably made $1 million off of you by now. And then when it comes to animals, we both love animals. We find a stray dog and pick him up and bring it home. She always gives us advice as a parent because we made her a grandma at an early age. And she's always there to help us out. Whenever I need her for a mother advice, she gave it to me. When she first FaceTimed my husband, when they first met, because she was on chemo, she told me he is the one having that caring trait, having that love trait from her. That's the best thing I got from her. And then when she passed away, my sister-in-law was pregnant. And my mom always believed in reincarnation because she's Buddhist. And always in our head that she had reincarnated to my little niece because her and my niece, they look just alike. I miss her every day. I do. When people say that you will slowly heal, you do, but you really don't. It's every day for me. I don't celebrate Christmas like I used to anymore because of that. Thanksgiving, my husband, he try to make it happen. He see it every day in my eyes. Mother's Day, her birthday, the day we lost her, is an everyday challenge for me.
The murders of Jackie Nguyen and Nhat Phan are solvable. Whether the motive in their case was a robbery of opportunity or something more, someone in the Metro Birmingham area can help resolve their case. Their families need the help of the Birmingham community to find answers. There is a cash reward of up to $5,000 available in their case. This information could be used to help bolster tips and leads. If you have any information in this case, please call Crime Stoppers of Metro Alabama at 205-254-7777 or visit their website at crimestoppersmetroal.org. The families are especially interested in people who may have been in the area of Top Perfect Nails on or around the time of Jackie and Nhat's murders on December 26th or 27th, 2010, and can offer insight into cars that may have been parked outside the business. Additionally, the families are seeking help in publicizing their loved one's case in the Birmingham area. If you're someone in the region who can help with advertising or a similar awareness campaign, or perhaps with flyer distribution, please get in contact with us at falllinepodcast@gmail.com. If you're interested, you can also write to the Birmingham Police Department to encourage their ongoing investigation of Nut Phan and Jackie Nguyen's case. A polite note letting them know that Nut and Jackie have not been forgotten and that we're all hoping for resolution could show more public interest in their homicides. This is especially true for Alabama residents. So we've included a template on the website that you can use in your letters, and you can find that link in the show notes. We'd also like to share information for those who have followed the Leon Lareles case. His niece Arlene has been raising money for several action items. We covered her efforts on our last updates episode and in a live episode we did a few months back. We're helping her to add to her fund, which will aid in attorney's fees, a memorial mural, and she hopes, eventually, private investigation fees. We're doing this by hosting the auction of items, including a podcast merch bundle of nearly 30 podcasts from our friends and ourselves, including podcasts like Generation Y, Swindled, and Voices for Justice, and a separate auction of 2023 VIP tickets and a hotel stay at the True Crime Podcast Festival, which will be held in Austin, Texas next year. The first auction for the merch bundle will begin on September 14th. Please follow our Instagram at @falllinepodcast to participate and to help Arlene raise funds. You can also donate directly to her GoFundMe, which will be linked in our show notes. If you know of a case that should be covered on the Fall Line, there's a link to our case submission form in the show notes as well. Thank you for listening. The Fall Line is an independently produced show, and we appreciate listener support. It allows us to do research, obtain FOIA, pay our content advisors, and support and donate to the causes we care about. If you try out the products we advertise, please use our sponsor codes. It really helps. And if you'd like to support the show and the stories we cover, join us on Patreon. We're raising Patreon funds to continue to fund the Millbrook Twins billboard and to pay for a therapy fund for families who've been on the show. We're happy to share that a third family member will be able to begin therapy, thanks to your continued support. Each and every one of our patrons helps us to continue this work, and we're so grateful for your help. On Patreon, you can get early release, ad-free versions of our regular episodes, plus blogs and the occasional live stream for only $5 a month. Or you can access the video live streams and the blogs for only a dollar. If you prefer Apple Premium, we're beginning that feed as well, so you'll have an alternative way to contribute. The Fall Line is written, hosted, and researched by Laura Norton, with additional research by Brian Waters, Kiana Burgess, and Michaela Morrill. Interviews by Brooke Hargrove. Produced, engineered, and scored by Moore Curry. Line editing by Bill Bertschinger. Content advisement by Brandy C. Williams, Liv Fallon, and Vic Kennedy. And, as always, our most special thanks to Angie Dodd and Sarah Turney. Currently, our monthly donation is going to private investigations for the missing. Please, join us in supporting this nonprofit. They need funds to help families access the services of PIs.